Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solotropia, Solotropia, Solotropia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solotropia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solotropia, Solotropia, Solotropia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solotropia all over God's green world.
Well, we multiplied, and so they gave nuclear power a try. But
don't you know we're gonna have a Solotropia, Solotropia, Solotropia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solotropia all over God's green world?
But the nuclear plants were built in haste, with too many risks and no place for waste. And so from
yes, indeed, the nuclear plants were built in haste, with no place to put the waste. This is Harvey Wasserman back for another Solotropia Green Power Wellness Show. Good. That was Pete Seeger, the legendary Pete Seeger, singing with David Burns and Dar Williams, the Rivertown Kids. That's the Solotropia song on the Grammy-winning Tomorrow's Children album from Appleseed Records. We've got a chock-full day today. Got a great guest with us, one of the true fonts of wisdom, a national treasure in terms of knowledge of nuclear power, Bob Alvarez, my erstwhile co-conspirator and co-author from the book Killing Our Own, The Disaster of America's Experience with Atomic Radiation, published way back in the previous millennium, 1982, I think it was. Was that right, Bob? Was it 1982?
Oh, yes. It was definitely... long ago.
Yeah, that's back when you and I were teenagers back
yeah,
then.
Yeah, that's right.
I remember,
we just learned how to read.
I think I vaguely remember you and I actually running. That's hard to imagine these
days.
Yeah,
we used to do that too.
Yeah. So, Bob, it's an honor to have you here. You're going to be with me for the full hour, and we have a ton to talk about. And I want to start with the accident at the Waste Isolation Pilot Project in New Mexico, because this is a situation where for the last half century, the nuclear power industry has been telling us that the solution to dealing with atomic waste, radioactive waste, has been with us all along, and that the only problem we have is politics, that people are politically opposed to having it in their backyard, and therefore, it's just all those, it's just Harry Reid and all those Nevada people, those the NIMBYs who are blocking nuclear waste. But something just happened at the Waste Isolation Project, Pilot Project. I want to explain, Bob Alvarez, my guest, is one of the world's leading experts in atomic radiation and specifically the atomic waste situation. Bob was with the Department of Energy for many years. He was with John Glenn's Senate Committee on these issues for many years and has studied Hanford and other nuclear waste sites probably more than anyone should be legally allowed, but certainly for decades. So, Bob, can you give us a rundown? And again, take your time. We got the full hour. It's important we get to the bottom of this. What exactly has happened at the Waste Isolation Pilot Project, and what are the implications for our nuclear waste?
A couple things happened there in February. On February 10th, I believe. Let me make sure I get my dates correct here. Just a moment here. Yeah, here it is. On February 4th, there was a large truck fire that raged underground at the Waste Isolation Pilot Project in New Mexico. This is a project that is the world's only operating high-hazard radioactive waste disposal site. It's in a salt formation, and it was it took many years to design and build and get licensed and approved.
Well, we're talking about decades, not just years.
Yeah, I mean, the Congress first appropriated money for authorized funds for it in 1979, and it was officially opened in early 1999. So it took about 20 years.
That's standard.
So it was set up to dispose of a certain kind of waste, which is mostly waste contaminated with plutonium. They picked the site because salt was the preferred medium, but the reason why WIP was this project was actually put together and made to run, it was that it was a crisis that trying to dispose of waste from the Rocky Flats plutonium fabrication plant after a 1969 fire, and they were sending all their contaminated waste up to a DOE site in Ohio, at Idaho National Lab. And the state of Idaho just got very upset about this and basically threatened to disrupt nuclear weapons production by halting waste shipments coming from Colorado, the Rocky Flats plant, to Idaho. And with the clout of the Idaho delegation in particular, and the governor, they pretty much convinced the U.S. government to build a repository for these wastes and to get that stuff out of Idaho as well. And it was waste that are contaminated with plutonium and other isotopes that are heavier than uranium, known as transuranic waste. So the site opened in 1999, and it seemed to be running smoothly, but then on February 4th of this year, a large truck caught fire underground. You have to understand that this is a very large series of caverns that have been carved out of a salt formation roughly a half a mile below ground, and it involves an ongoing salt mining operation and also the shipment and then emplacement of packages of these wastes containing these transuranic elements that are going down to these gigantic rooms. And so this is a huge salt mine that's got a footprint that's substantially larger than the Pentagon's. And they put these waste packages in rooms that are roughly larger than three football fields.
A single room is bigger than three football fields?
Yeah.
And where town is this near?
Carlsbad, New Mexico.
Okay, so that's...
So anyway, the truck, a salt truck caught fire. And it raged for several hours because they weren't able to put it out, and the tires caught fire, and it created a huge amount of dense smoke inside of the mining operation. And at the time, they had to evacuate something like 86 people because of the smoke hazard, and it took a long time for them to put out the fire. So on February 14th, another event happened, which we're not sure if they're connected, but people working outside on the surface, who all the people had been evacuated because of the fire, were showing up with contamination from the mine that was coming out of a duct system that was traveling a half a mile up to the surface, and something like 20 workers were contaminated with this stuff who had not been underground. So this then begged the question, well, what's happened here? Why was, this stuff is not supposed to be leaking, certainly above ground at any time at all. So that then prompted a major investigation that's underway right now, and the shipments of these wastes have stopped. And where they're heading with the investigation is that it was very likely caused by an explosion of a drum or drums that contained materials that either were generating flammable gases like hydrogen, or the current story that's coming out is that they might have been putting organic kitty litter inside the waste packages, and the waste themselves, many of these wastes contain are in what they call nitrate compounds. So when you mix organics with nitrates, those are the basic ingredients for an explosive material. This is explosions 101.
So this is and I'm assuming this is a Department of Energy, or a Department of Defense facility, isn't that right,
No,
Bob?
It's a Department of Energy facility.
But it's mostly military waste, is that
yeah,
right?
Yeah, it's waste generated from the production of nuclear weapons, and it's waste that was generated from making and processing plutonium, primarily.
For nuclear weapons.
Yeah, for nuclear weapons, that's
so,
correct.
And we're probably accurate to say that they really spared no expense on this facility. This is supposed to be a showcase facility.
Well, it is what it is. I mean, they've spent, they estimate they'll spend about a total of $7.2 billion on it. The waste isolation pilot plant has been operating, has been operating, since 1999, so it's going on for, 15 plus years. And so they've put in about 170,000 waste containers containing nearly 5 metric tons of plutonium.
God, metric tons of plutonium?
Are stored down there. And
so just to keep that in perspective, it takes, about 12 pounds of plutonium to make the bomb that destroyed Hiroshima?
Roughly speaking, yeah. So, and then the waste packages are disposed in a 100-acre area that includes 7 rooms, and each with a footprint as large as 3 football fields have been carved out of the salt formation.
God.
So there's a lot of stuff down there, and so they've had to close it down, and they aren't, they can only send people down there in very limited times and only in very limited numbers because the fire impacted the main hoist that gets people in and out of that place in any large number, which happens to be the same hoist where they bring down and then store the waste. So they sent robots down, and then they've sent people down, in total protective garb, including supplied air. We call them moon suits. And you can only work for so long down in a mine like that with those kinds of outfits on, because it's just gets oppressively hot and it gets very difficult. So, but what they have found is that they have found evidence of disturbance of material that indicates that one or other drums probably exploded and leaked out the contents into the environment underground.
Oh my God! So this is as you say, Bob Alvarez. This is the only underground nuclear waste facility operating in the world.
The only what you would call high hazard radioactive waste disposal site in the world.
Because we do have bunches of dumps where they take
low-level
stuff.
Yeah, I mean, but those are what are called low-level wastes, and they are in shallow burial, which some of these shallow burial grounds also have a lot of plutonium in them, but, the government really didn't officially recognize the hazards of these wastes until 1970, even though they recognized the hazards of those wastes being handled were very, very radiotoxic. But in terms of disposing of them, until 1970, this stuff was put into cardboard boxes and dumped in shallow burial grounds. So there's a whole bunch of this waste that's still sitting in shallow burial at the Energy Department sites where there are no plans right now to bring it out. So, But the repository shut down. They're still having investigations. One investigation was completed about the truck fire, and it was rather, very harsh in its findings.
Well, how exactly does a truck that's hauling salt a half mile underground catch fire?
Well, what happened is that this truck was put down there in 1985 and never properly maintained.
Oh, God.
And so they they believe that the hydraulic lines or the fuel lines basically failed and spilled flammable liquids onto the engine and caused the engine to catch fire and then the large truck tires to catch fire. And there were large spots of oil and flammable material from the leaking trucks because they hadn't been properly maintained.
Jeez. And this is our nuclear waste program, and this is what the critics of the anti-nuclear movement say is a political problem as opposed to a technical one.
It's a complicated problem because there was a time when I was working in the Department of Energy and shortly thereafter when they started up the plant that I think they were a little bit more rigorous in their safety culture. And what happens at a lot of these nuclear facilities that I've sort of studied over the years is that some of them start off, you know, with very good safety records, and then things change and people turn over, and then they sort of go down in their safety culture, and then problems happen. Or sometimes they'll start off with a lousy safety culture and improve. So, but here's a situation where I think that was a product of a safety culture that just got very complacent. And you can't be complacent with this stuff. And, you know, when you have a system that's really operating on contractors getting incentivized by how many packages they can put together and get into that repository as bonuses, and if you don't have adequate federal oversight to, you know, basically make sure that what they say is in the package is correct and that which is not supposed to be in the packages is not present, then you got problems. And what's happened is that I think this project has gone off the wheels largely because the Department of Energy has relinquished its authority to regulate these operations to contractors who are basically there to grab bonuses.
God, what a sick situation. Bob, you're still senior fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies, is that correct?
Yeah, I'm a senior scholar.
Senior scholar. And you've been on the nuclear case for, what, 30, 40 years now?
It's going on 40 years.
Yeah,
it's
really.
Longer than I had intended, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's for sure. And, of course, there's nothing
But, you know, the other thing is there's a lot of these wastes that are still sitting at these energy department sites that are piling up where they currently don't have anywhere to go. And so, and there was some interest one of the reasons why there's so much plutonium in the WIP is that in the late 1990s, right before as WIP was opening, the U.S. government made a decision to dispose of plutonium that was actually deliberately set aside as part of the active stockpile to make nuclear weapons. Just declare it as waste, and they disposed about 3.5 tons in WIP. So about 70% of the plutonium in the WIP was originally meant to be put into nuclear weapons. It wasn't even waste.
Wow. And that stuff was made at Rocky Flats, is that correct?
Yeah, there was the residues at Rocky Flats that were supposed to be recycled that were officially considered part of the active strategic stockpile of plutonium.
So in the big picture, what is this? I guess some actual human beings were seriously exposed to radiation with these two incidents at WIP. Is that correct?
I don't know. I mean, there has been the information about how much leaked out and what kind of exposures workers received really hasn't been all that clear other than statements made that the levels were very small.
Well, that's standard. I mean, they're always very
smart. Yeah, I'm just saying that this is what the information that is currently available to us. So that's kind of what the story is. So,
do they have plans to reopen this thing?
Well, I think I'm sure they do have plans. The problem is that how do you plan to open something when you don't know all the full facts of why it's shut now? And that's going to be a big problem because, if the problem had to do with the fact that nobody was sort of checking the casks before they went to the site, then they're going to have to look at all these containers at these sites to see what they're doing, you know, whether they've got them properly packaged before they can be sent. Or, you know, the other thing is that the smoke damage from the truck fire, interestingly enough, damaged the main hoist, which is the main way, the main means by which you send waste down there and large numbers of people. So until that hoist is repaired, they aren't going to be able to send any workers down there. And then the big question that has yet to be answered is it really safe for them to go down there? Mm-hmm. And if it isn't, what are they going to do? I mean, how do you clean up a contaminated disposal site, underground disposal site? I mean, these are all sort of questions that have to be answered before you can really think of starting this stuff up.
Yeah, and unfortunately, the vernacular is expanding its territory. We had to worry about this at Fermi 1 in 1966, at Chalk River in 1952, at Three Mile Island in 1979, at Chernobyl in 1986, now at Fukushima in 2011. All the Soviet sites with the nuclear weapons. This is getting to be an epidemic, let's put it that way. So, Bob Alvarez, what does this say about the ability of our society, of our species, to handle radioactive materials over the long term?
Well, I mean, we can go on about this, but I think that the notion that we can find a safe, permanent repository of these wastes in our current generation's lifespan is sort of illusory. And that we have to seriously think about the best way to safely contain this stuff on the surface until we can really figure out the right way of finding ultimate disposal underground.
Well, we got 70,000 tons of high-level spent fuel at reactor sites. What do you advocate?
I think it's sort of this. Unavoidable reality is that these sites have become not just generators of electricity, but major radioactive waste management sites. They're storing, some of the largest concentrations of artificial radioactivity on the planet. And the problem is that the whole framework to find a safe place to dispose of this material effectively has collapsed. And so that's because of a lot of reasons, but a major reason is the fact that the Yucca Mountain disposal site was canceled for both political and technical reasons. They're both, to me, very credible, both politically and technically. But anyway, the reality is that these reactors that continue to operate are going to be generating these wastes, and they're not going to be leaving there anytime soon in the foreseeable future. And so this waste is going to continue to pile up, and it's going to prove to be a real issue because of the fact it's going to stay there for several decades, for some indefinite period.
God.
So, I mean, the most realistic thing people should be doing is thinking about the safest way of storing this stuff to keep it from escaping into the environment over any period of time, and then figure out the most robust ways of storing this. This is why I've been long advocating that we try to remove as much spent fuel from vulnerable pools and put them into dry, hardened storage modes.
Well, tell us about that. So we have God knows how many actual rods in assemblies, 70,000 tons worth, much of which is still in swimming pools, which are way overstacked at these nuclear reactors. So are you advocating that what are you advocating in terms of the higher
waste? Well, that we basically reduce as much of the spent fuel that's currently in pools as possible, because it's a much more consequential problem if you have an accident. I mean, if water is drained either partially or fully from a spent fuel pool, that spent fuel will heat up and the cladding around it will catch fire. And the problem is these pools are not under any kind of heavy thick containment like reactors. They were meant to be storage, temporary storage operations where no more than one-fifth or one-fourth of what they hold would be kept there. So the amount of radioactivity that could escape from a what they call a zirconium fire or a spent fuel pool fire would dwarf that of a reactor meltdown.
Well, let's discuss this for a minute. The spent fuel rods, the rods go into the reactor, the commercial reactor. They're made incredibly radioactive.
Right.
And then they come out, they can't sustain, after a certain time, although they're unbelievably radioactive, they still can't sustain a chain reaction. And so they're
they can, but it's not not enough to make it worth your while to generate electricity.
Right. Of course, now we have something called high burn-up fuel.
Yeah, well, but what happens is that this spent fuel, because it's irradiated now for periods as long as 6 years in these reactors, when the fuel is removed, it's extremely, extremely radioactive. I mean, you have to be, this is stuff that, any contact with a matter of seconds could prove lethal. That this stuff is not only highly radioactive, but because the radioactive products in there, which are a myriad of them, many of them decay, and when they decay and into other, and eventually to stable isotopes, they give off a lot of heat, and it's this thermal heat that's a problem. Is that when water is something? If water is drained from a pool by accident or by an act of malice or something like that, by the time the water would reach the top of the spent fuel, the radiation doses coming off of the spent fuel pool would probably be lethal within tens of yards or maybe 100 yards. You can't get near it. And then when the water starts to drain down, and we're talking about a period of several hours going on here. This is not something that happens all of a sudden during during a feature-length movie. That decay heat causes heats up the cladding, the tubing around the reactors, which is made of a very reactive metal known as zirconium. For those of us who remember flash bulbs and cameras way back when, those flash bulbs had zirconium filaments in them. So when that zirconium reaches a certain temperature, about 1,000 degrees centigrade, it basically spontaneously catches fire, and like a giant sparkler, a giant Roman candle, and it releases all this radioactive material that's volatilized, especially an isotope called cesium-137. When you think about cesium-137, and you think that, if you understand what happened at places like Fukushima, is that, quantities in terms of tens of pounds of cesium were released to the environment. And that relatively small amount in terms of weight wound up causing 160,000 people to be evacuated from their homes.
God, we're talking with Bob Alvarez, reading.
So, with a spent fuel pool fire, the amount of cesium-137 that could be released would be far greater than from a reactor, because it's got several reactors worth of spent fuel sitting in there, in buildings that are not heavied up enough. So, and if you put the stuff in dry storage, I mean, there's plenty of information out there. I mean, in terms of what the relative risks are. I mean, you're talking about reducing the amount of radioactivity that might be released from a dry storage cask if someone tries to put an explosive on it or something like that. the reduction compared to a spent fuel pool fire would be, you know, like 2,500 times in terms of the amount that gets released.
My God. We're talking with Bob Alvarez.
Bob understands this stuff.
Bob, we're talking with Bob Alvarez, one of the world's leading experts on radioactive waste. It's terrifying stuff, Bob. You filled us in a bit on the waste isolation pilot project fire, which, as far as I'm concerned, really puts a nail in the coffin of this idea that we can even handle this stuff at all. We really need to stop creating it. Bob, we're going to take a short 3-minute break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little more about nuclear waste, but I want to talk about health and environmental, health and radiation, and especially Dr. Alice Stewart and Dr. Ernest Sternglass. So we'll be right back after we hear the Rocky Top version of the Solartopia song from our boy Dana Lyons and Cows with Guns.
Coal plants, new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better...
PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
This is Cliff Stewart with a Just Cause Coast to Coast, where we bring education, awareness, and information about judicial injustice. AJC Coast to Coast is the place to listen to topics about the fight against wrongful convictions, judicial injustice, and corruption. Join us every Sunday with Sam Thurman, Ethel Lopez, and me from 10:30 a.m. to 12:30 Eastern Time on Progressive Radio Network. That's PRN.FM.
Does the current dire state of the economy have you totally upset and confused? There are solutions to our financial ills, but first we have to get a handle on what's really going on. I'm Ellen Brown, author of Web of Debt and a new radio show host here on PRN-FM, inviting you to join me and my co-host, Walt McCree, as we look behind the curtain at the shadowy world of global monetary control and what we can do to break ourselves free. The show is called It's Our Money, and it airs on Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll be talking with experts in the world of monetary policy, as well as with people who are actively working to reclaim control of public money to benefit the public interest. So please join us for It's Our Money, Wednesdays on PRN, FM, or by podcast.
Progressive Radio News Hour is an antidote to government and corporate propaganda. Distinguished guests are featured. Some are world figures. All are independent thinkers. Truth and full disclosure are featured. Vital domestic and world issues mattering most are discussed. Today is the most perilous time in world history. Ukraine's crisis escalated things dangerously. It's the gravest one since World War II. A potential clash of civilizations looms. More than ever, vital information is needed. It's our most precious commodity. How we use it matters most. Peace and security depend on it. The Progressive Radio News Hour, 3 times weekly, live on Sundays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, plus 2 pre-recorded archive programs. Make it a regular habit and stay informed.
Source for the best in progressive radio. Radio.
Coal plants, new plants, oil refineries, pipelines, mega dams. Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan. Suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam. Road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia. It's time to get a better plan. Solartopia,
Green Powered Energy. We're back here with the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. That's Harvey Wasserman talking to you. That was Dana Lyons, the Rocky Top version of the Solartopia song. See Dana Lyons at Cows with Guns, the vegetarian anthem. We're talking with the great Bob Alvarez for more than 30 years, although he's quite young for his age. Bob Alvarez has been the leading expert on many aspects of the atomic fuel cycle and the nuclear power issue, as well as issues of health. Bob, you almost single-handedly, as far as I could tell, back in the 1970s and 80s, helped sustain researchers like Alice Stewart and Thomas Mancuso, Ernest Sternglass, who did the pioneer research on the impacts of health and on health from commercial atomic power and other forms of radioactive emitters. In particular, Dr. Sternglass, who is about 90 now and in a home, he's still with us, but I do want to talk about the evolution of the issue of radiation and health and how radiation affects the human body and what we know and don't know and what we are told and not told. Now, as I recall in particular, there was some discussion of the health impacts of atomic radiation, of course, with the initial discovery of X-ray, where people would stick their hands in these X-ray machines and, you know, leave them there for a half hour or so and amazingly enough, get cancer. And then Madame Curie died of cancer, and many of the women who worked in the radium watchdial factories. But the first major epidemiological study turned out to have been done by Dr. Alice Stewart in England. Can you talk to us about Dr. Alice Stewart, Bob? Because you knew her very well, and you helped support her work.
Sure. Dr. Stewart was a physician and an epidemiologist who was at Oxford University. And in the 1950s, she and her colleagues published the first study that indicated that children who are getting exposed, or women who are getting exposed during pregnancy, are likely to increase the risk of cancer to the children. This was first reported in 1956, and it caused a rather huge uproar at the time. And she was able to, despite the efforts to shut her down, close her down, for many years she received support from the Food and Drug Administration of all agencies, and was able to expand her study till it became one of the largest studies of its kind in the world. And by 1970, the FDA and the medical profession officially discouraged the exposure to pregnant women to X-rays and medical radiation.
But along the way, Dr. Stewart was severely attacked by many, many physicians and, of course, by the nuclear industry.
Oh, yes. And she managed to, keep her study going. And her way of dealing with her critics was to continue to publish in the scientific literature. I mean, she's one of the founders of modern epidemiology. People don't know much about her. But, you know, she's one of the people who was on the ground floor of the whole modern field of epidemiological research, which is, you know, studying what happens to people.
And, of course, her findings are really responsible for the fact that somewhere along the line, most or all doctors stopped X-raying pregnant women.
Oh, absolutely. And there was quite a bit of controversy, and people generated studies that said there was no such thing, and there are still people today who believe that the because there are studies that raise doubt about it, therefore we need to be doubtful and not accept it. But the fact of the matter is that the medical profession pretty much has accepted her findings, and that the nuclear industry, in particular, has resisted those findings because it implies that that the fetus and the embryo is much more sensitive to radiation, that the exposure levels that you would need to protect essentially the unborn child would be cost prohibitive in certain areas, and that when you're projecting harm to human beings, it's easier to sort of hide behind a cloud of uncertainty than to sort of say, well, this is what some of the data shows, and we should be concerned about the worst possible case.
Well, but the bottom line is that what Dr. Alistair showed, and what was, I guess, accepted, you're saying, in general by the FDA and the medical community by 1970, is that even a single X-ray involving a pregnant woman can have significant health consequences.
Yes, she and her colleague George Neal published a pioneering paper in The Lancet in 1970 that specifically stated that a single pelvimetric X-ray delivered during pregnancy would more than double the risk of the child developing cancer later on in life.
And so when, not to belabor the point here, but in 1979, when Three Mile Island melted, the nuclear industry reassured the public by saying that the average dose in central Pennsylvania from the accident at Three Mile Island would be merely the equivalent of a single chest X-ray, neglecting to mention Dr. Stewart and Neely's findings that such an X-ray could, in fact, double the childhood leukemia rate among the embryo and fetus at the time.
Well, I think what we've learned since that accident is that those statements were arm-waving gestures. That, you know, while not a lot of the particulate radiation escaped, a very large amount of the short-lived gaseous radiation escaped, and that stuff is very hard to detect and measure, but it can be very harmful if you're standing in the wrong place at the wrong time. So, and I think Ernest Sternglass, to his eternal credit, was the first to show up near the reactor and urged that pregnant women be evacuated and forced the state of Pennsylvania to do this. And he took tremendous criticism. You know, New York Times took issue with him and thought that he was being an alarmist. And but I think what he did was something that should have been any responsible federal agency should have done immediately.
Well, I recall, of course, all that very well. Dr. Sternglass was a radiologist, a professor of radiology at the University of Pittsburgh. And his story, nine years prior to Three Mile Island, or a decade, as I understand it, and Bob, correct me, and we are talking about Dr. Ernest Sternglass, who's still very much with us, but in a home now. We want to try and honor our people while they're still with us. Dr. Sternglass, apparently, at a time when very few people, if anyone, questioned the health impacts of commercial nuclear power, Dr. Sternglass apparently received in the mail a package of data about radiation releases from the shipping port reactor outside of Pittsburgh, which was the first commercial reactor to open in the world, actually, opening in 1959. And Dr. Sternglass looked at these doses and concluded that they could, in fact, be doing harm to the general public. Is that correct?
That's correct. And he also became very concerned, particularly after Dr. Stewart's findings were being steadily confirmed, that these radiation releases were being portrayed as relatively minor and nothing to be concerned about, and when in fact that they could increase the risk of harm to people.
And so Dr. Sternglass published a book called Secret Fallout.
Yep.
Which was the first of all books to directly relate radioactive fallout from commercial nuclear reactors to potential health impacts, human health impacts. Is that correct?
Well, I mean, he was not the first. I think he was. I think John Goffman and Arthur Tamplin in 1969, who were then working at Lawrence Livermore Laboratory in California for the then Atomic Energy Commission, published a book called Poison Power,
Okay, so my understanding, Bob, what's
but I think where Ernest really made his name first of all, and had the effect of sort of waking up Templeton and Goffman, was that he published a paper in Esquire magazine, pointing out that a major nuclear exchange involving anti-ballistic missiles at this time, this is in the late 1960s, would result in many, many thousands of children dying from cancer.
The title of the article, as I recall, was "The Death of All Children."
That's correct.
And it, I believe, it prompted actually the Congress to kill the anti-ballistic missile
program. Well, I think it certainly had an effect on the public, and I think that what Sternglass did also woke up the nuclear industry to begin to establish efforts to counter what he was claiming. And so, you know, that's been sort of one of the things that's been going on, is that he's been denounced a lot and subject to a lot of criticism, and a lot of this is, you know, in my opinion, generated by pure self-interest.
Right. And so we're talking about three of the great heroes, really, of the nuclear age. Dr. Alice Stewart, who was basically crucified for years for pointing out that medical x-rays could result in a doubled childhood leukemia rate among the offspring of the women who were x-rayed during pregnancy, and followed by Drs. Ernest Sternglass and John Goffman, who, along with Arthur Templeton, a researcher from the RAND Corporation, who pointed out that so-called normal releases from commercial nuclear power plants could, in fact, harm the general population.
That's right.
And Dr. Goffman at the time, Sternglass was a professor of radiology at the University of Pittsburgh. Dr. Goffman was the chief medical officer of the Atomic Energy Commission, for God's sakes. And my understanding is that the AEC told him, he did a study with Templeton that concluded that a very large number, I believe it was 32,000 Americans would die every year from normal commercial atomic reactor emissions. And the AEC told him to change his findings, as I recall, and he would not. Is that correct?
That's right. And they were pretty much cast out of the system for it.
Right.
You know, they were basically put into exile, I guess. You know, because they held very senior positions in the nuclear establishment and found themselves out of work.
Yeah, essentially they were forced to Siberia. Now, what I didn't know, you know, I knew John, you and I both knew John Goffman for many,
yeah,
many years. I never knew that he was a pioneer pathfinder, a researcher, and blazed a lot of new trails of knowledge in the field of LDL cholesterol.
Yes,
and,
yes.
He must have done that before he was head of the AEC.
Yes, he did it. He was basically involved in coronary health research for most of his career until the 1960s.
That's amazing. And I guess some of his research really made an impact. I don't know exactly what he found about LDL cholesterol. So I read somewhere that he actually discovered LDL cholesterol. I don't know if that's possible.
Well, maybe.
But nonetheless, Dr. Goffman, to his eternal credit, held his ground, refused to change his findings about the health impacts of radiation, and went on to say, a direct quote from Dr. John Goffman, former chief medical officer of the Atomic Energy Commission, he characterized commercial atomic power as premeditated mass murder. Oh, my God.
Or, what was it, random and indiscriminate.
Yes. And, you know, he was by no means a wild and crazy guy. I mean, John Goffman had PhDs in both nuclear chemistry and medical degrees.
That's right. And he was also a student of Glenn Seaborg and was a co-discoverer of uranium-233 during the very early days of the Manhattan Project. So
right.
He has all these credentials as also being essentially a nuclear pioneer at the dawn of the nuclear age.
Right. I once heard a flack from the nuclear industry say that John Goffman had been discredited. I mean, that's like discrediting God. You know, I mean, come on. And Dr. Ernest Sternglass, just for the record, has had... I talked to him about it. I couldn't follow it, of course, but he had a unified theory of the universe, which he personally spent an entire day discussing with Albert Einstein.
Yeah.
Apparently, as a young student, Ernest, and it would be characteristic of him, drove to Princeton and knocked on Dr. Einstein's door. I don't know if he wrote him in advance or not. Dr. Einstein considered him credible enough to spend significant time with Ernie about his unified string theory of the universe.
Well, they've subsequently looked further into Einstein's personal papers and discovered that after that visit that he had with Sternglass, he pondered this for quite a long time.
Yeah, and so Ernest Sternglass, who a lovely, lovely guy, a tremendous heart, wonderfully compassionate, and absolutely brilliant scientist and researcher, with a statistician named Jay Gould, and a younger acolyte who is still working on this case, thank goodness, because he's just about the only one, Joseph Mangano from the Radiation Health Project, has carried on their work and is pretty much the go-to guy these days at the Radiation Health Project for the ongoing impacts of radiation on human health, including findings, Bob, that you've probably seen, that the childhood thyroid, the thyroid cancer rate among children in a sample of about 250,000 children in the Fukushima area, the actual thyroid cancers are up by a factor of 40, and that in a population where you would expect about 3 childhood thyroid cancers in a normal population, they found well over 120. I mean, it's a staggering number. And Joe has also confirmed, Joe Mangano has also confirmed that there are 46%, it's a stunning number, 46% of the children in this 250,000 children study around Fukushima has some kind of thyroid abnormalities, cysts or growths or other things. And Bob, in your long history as a health researcher, where does that take us?
Well, I mean, I think it takes us. I think we're going to see a repetition of a rather sad and tragic story. Is that first the early evidence appears and people just totally deny and attack it and pay no attention until the evidence is so overwhelming, and by that time it's too late to have saved people.
I remember you referring to this as the bodies in the morgue
approach to public health.
Yeah.
Yes, I mean, one of the little things that I think that folks like Alice Stewart and Dr. Thomas Mancuso truly deserve is that in their late careers, they took on the nuclear weapons program, which up to that time dominated the whole area of radiation health effects research, and pointed out that the workers who were making plutonium at Hanford for the nuclear weapons program were dying from radiation-induced cancers, and they were subject to an enormous firestorm of criticisms, and they tried to seize his data. They tried to shove him into premature retirement. Dr. Stewart, who is no stranger to this kind of rough and tumble world, succeeded in publishing continued analyses. And what happened as a result of this long struggle is that there was an effort made by my boss, Senator John Glenn, which succeeded in moving the radiation health effects research out of the nuclear weapons program, which it had dominated from the very beginning, into more mainstream public health research. And that then led to opening up this research to more outside institutions like universities and the like. And what happened is that those studies, especially of the workers that were initially discredited or so-called discredited by the critics of Mancuso and Stewart and Neal, found that they were right, and that by the year 2000, the U.S. government had concluded, based on these studies, that it had put its workers in harm's way and set up an unprecedented compensation program. That compensation program today has provided essentially provided compensation to more than 100,000 individuals in excess of $10 billion.
Wow. Well, we're talking about Bob Alvarez. We've got just 3 minutes
left. No, I mean, it's too late, too little and too late, you know, if you lose a loved one and a survivor. But I think what it is testament to is the fact is that these researchers like Mancuso and Stewart and Neal and Sternglass, Goffin, and others who are basically treated like pariahs because they come into direct conflict with very powerful interests, is that what we've learned is that in the end, as Dr. Stewart would say, truth is the daughter of time.
Yeah, and they really, the ultimate impact, you know, when you talk about compensation, is that at least we have acknowledgement that there are dangers here that need to be avoided, and that you know, we can't mess around with this stuff and think that it's not.
Well,
and what
adds to this, you know, and I think that there's sort of a cultural element of distrust about things nuclear that's deeply ingrained in the American culture, and I think a lot of it has to do with how the nuclear weapons program misled the public during the 1950s and early 60s about fallout.
Yes.
And we've learned now that they went so far as to basically commit acts of fraud in federal court, deliberately sent miners into working conditions that absolutely guaranteed they would get ill, and they decided not to do anything about it.
And they've exposed the public. Bob, we're in our last 30 seconds. They've exposed the public to increased radiation from commercial nuclear power plants, and as you've discussed in the first half hour here, the failure of the nuclear waste program. We've been talking with the great Bob Alvarez, whose contributions to public health have been incalculable. Bob, thanks so much for being with us. You're at the senior scholar at the Institute for Policy Studies. I assume people can reach you through there. And this, again, has been the Solartopia Green Power and Wellness Show. Thanks again, Bob Alvarez. Look on the website to find out how you can contact him. We'll be back again next week with another scintillating show on how, for God's sakes, we can survive the nuclear age. We will see you next week in Solartopia.
Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia.
So we went digging into the ground and started to burn.